This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, January the 26th, and it's time for our Friday Week in Review. Every Friday after 8, we talk with two guests from different political perspectives about the top news of the week, and we will do that this hour from the State of the Union to issues going on right here in the state of Wisconsin. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number if you'd like to bring up a topic from the news this week. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We are very happy to have with us this hour two former congressional candidates, one who ran as a Republican and one as a Democrat, as our two Week in Review guests today. John Sharpless, professor of history at UW-Madison, a Republican candidate for Congress in 2000. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also joining us, Paul Soglin, former mayor of Madison, Democratic candidate for Congress in 1996, currently an attorney for Epic Systems. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome back. I'm glad to have you back on the Week in Review. You are also the blogger for waxingamerica.com, so we'll check that out, too.
Okay.
Let's talk about the State of the Union. Here's what President Bush, one of the things he had to say.
Some in this chamber are new to the House and the Senate, and I congratulate the Democrat majority. Congress has changed, but not our responsibilities. Each of us is guided by our own convictions, and to these we must stay faithful. Yet we're all held to the same standards and called to serve the same good purposes.
Just starting with you, Paul Soglin, what did you think of the State of the Union?
Pretty miserable. probably one of the most hypocritical State of the Union messages we've ever received. When he made those comments, he went on to make two other remarks. One is that it was time to balance the federal budget. I found it very curious that he's placing a great deal of emphasis now on balancing the federal budget. Now that the Democrats control Congress, he wants to put the monkey on their back. He was not going to attempt to impose that on a Republican Congress. And, of course, the second one is ending the practice of earmarks, which has been the source of endless billions of dollars of squandered money that the Republicans threw out there into their own districts. Now that the Republicans no longer have control, he wants to end that practice.
Yeah. It might have been subtle, but he said the Democrat Party. Was that a jab?
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that he's trying to find a strategy to survive the next 2 years. When you're at 30% in the polls and you've already managed to outstrip Richard Nixon in unpopularity without even being impeached, and you do feel, he obviously feels some obligation to try and continue his tenure in office, he's got to maneuver himself into a position where, as I said, he puts the monkey on their back.
Yeah. So, John Sharpless, what struck you about the State of the Union address?
Well, there's a lot of hypocrisy in just about every State of the Union address. I'm opposed to this ritual. The Constitution calls for a message to Congress. And apart from George Washington right at the beginning, all the presidents down to Woodrow Wilson sent Congress a report on the state of the nation. Mm-hmm. And then they started initially to speak to Congress, and it was on the radio, and now it's on television. We have this ritual of guests in the balcony that we nod to. If a president is recently triumphant, he kind of shoves it into the face of the opposition. If he's recently humiliated, as this president was in the last election, then he's conciliatory. And then they start down the laundry list all the way to every kid should have a toothbrush. And most presidents that go through the, remember Clinton's, what would go on, you know, you'd move from subject to subject, and there was always something for everybody in the audience. And then his crowd would applaud, and the other side would sit down. It's silly. It doesn't serve us nationally in any fundamental way. Constitutionally, the president is required to send a message to Congress on the State of the Union, not all this silly symbolic crap. And
John, if we eliminated this ceremony, we would not have the enjoyment and fun of watching how many times Nancy Pelosi blinks.
Yeah, she was really blinking away.
60 seconds, as opposed to Dick Cheney, who, I mean, none of us are surprised that he didn't blink perhaps for hours.
It is amazing. That man's face is frozen.
Yeah, but what was he popping in his mouth? Did you notice that?
I don't want to know. As a good Republican, he shouldn't be using drugs.
Maybe it was a breath mint. Let's here's another clip from the State of the Union address.
I've spoken with many of you in person. I respect you and the arguments you've made. We went into this largely united in our assumptions and in our convictions. And whatever you voted for, you did not vote for failure. Our country is pursuing a new strategy in Iraq, and I ask you to give it a chance to work. And I ask you to support our troops in the field and those on their way.
So, Paul Soglin, should America give this new strategy in Iraq a chance?
It's an old strategy. It's a failed strategy. Let me add another sentence or two from that speech. This is not the fight we entered in Iraq, but it is the fight we are in. Every one of us wishes that this war were over and won. This is Vietnam all over again, and this is the tragedy of American foreign policy. This is the tragedy of this president, that he has learned absolutely nothing, even from his own experiences when he was of college age or in his tenure in public office through the years. This notion that we can go into a country and gain popular support when there are so many other variables there other than the ones we think are important. I mean, you know, let's just go back to Vietnam, the domino theory. I mean, as we knew at the time in truth and as we know today, the North Vietnamese were not part of a communist surge that was going to overrun Southeast Asia. And in fact, as noted during the opposition to the war in Vietnam, the Vietnamese had a long history of hostility with the Chinese. And in fact, there were border wars between the Vietnamese and the Chinese following that war. We went into this war with no under... This president went into this war with no understanding of the differences between the sectarian factions in Iraq, no understanding of what the society valued, and now he simply wants to do more of the same.
John Tropos?
Well, one of the things I find fascinating as a historian is that people who defend this war often draw an analogy to World War II, the glorious war for the defeat of Nazism. And they talk about a Marshall Plan and liberating a people from a dictator. And people who don't like the war often liken it to Vietnam and strike analogies as Paul has. It's neither. Get out of the past, Paul. It's not Vietnam. It's not World War II. It's happening in Iraq. It has its own dynamism that's separate and completely different in the context of the 21st century. And I think trying to argue about this war by analogy is just silly. Now to George Bush and the speech. He clearly is in trouble with Congress and the American people. They've lost faith in this war. Whether the war was a good war or was not a good war, it was clearly poorly managed. Even on his own terms, it was poorly managed. I can't imagine that he and Cheney and Rumsfeld set out as a goal to lose their majority in Congress and have the casualty levels and at this time. And let's say that one of the goals was free-flowing oil to the West. They haven't even managed that very well because we know that Iraq isn't even close to its original oil capacity. So even if it was a war for oil, it hasn't even resolved that problem. The troop level thing, and I'm going to be very critical of Bush on this, is largely a sham. Most of the inflated troop levels will not come from more deployment. It will be from extending the tours of duty over there on an already taxed Army and Marine Corps, asking a trooper to stay another 6 months past his limit is appalling. And that's how they're actually going to inflate the numbers over there. The actual redeployment of new troops is very small in this. And I will agree with Paul. I think it's hard to know what he says. I'm sending more troops. That's fine. what are they going to do to alter the situation, which is on the right on the edge of civil war?
Paul Soglin, go ahead.
I will concede the point that we shouldn't make the analogy to Vietnam. On its own, without any lessons from history, this war was a disaster, and mainly because there was a lack of understanding of what was going on in the Middle East. And it's just stunning to me, the level of ignorance that, I mean, let's damn them with praise to the UW History Department. You've got graduate students. You've got undergraduate students who have a better understanding of the relationship of the Sunnis and the Shiites, who have an understanding between the interests of the Saudi Arabians as opposed to the Syrians, than this administration had. And when you ask the question, could they have wanted to go into this intending failure and the loss of all these troops? Obviously, the answer is no. So then the question becomes, okay, how did they believe this would happen? I'm fearful that it's at such a base level that they truly believe that they were anointed, that they were on a mission from God, and that they were destined to succeed.
We are talking with Paul Soglin, former mayor of Madison, a Democratic candidate for Congress in 1996, currently an attorney for Epic Systems, and he runs a blog, waxingamerica.com, and John Sharpless, professor of history at UW-Madison, a Republican candidate for Congress in 2000, are two guests for this edition of the Friday Week in Review. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, if you'd like to join in. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Join Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. It's your views on the news after 4. Ben will welcome your commentary on the top news stories of the week after 4 o'clock this afternoon. We're reviewing the top news stories of the week this week with John Sharpless and Paul Soglin. It's our Friday Week in Review. And John Sharpless, let me get your reaction to what Republican Senator Chuck Hagel had to say at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting the other day when it passed a non-binding resolution condemning President Bush's plan to build up troops in Iraq.
There is no strategy. This is a ping pong game with American lives. These young men and women that we put in Anbar province, in Iraq, in Baghdad, are not beans. They're real lives. And we better be damn sure we know what we're doing, all of us, before we put 22,000 more Americans into that grinder.
He was the only Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee to vote for this resolution that says the buildup in Iraq is not in the nation's best interest. John Sharpless, what do you think?
Well, it has to be remembered that there's been a wing of the party that never really accepted this project. If you'll remember right at the beginning, a lot of the people like Pat Buchanan are very isolationist, and they felt we had no interest in the Middle East. And I think what's happened with the continued lack of success, that group has grown. And clearly among Republicans, there's a substantial dissenting group now. And obviously the election sent a message that the American people have lost patience. So I think Hagel is actually speaking for a growing number of Republicans who are questioning their president's policy. It's very interesting here. I think Bush has gotten himself, obviously, in the last 2 years of any presidency, it's difficult to have momentum. Clinton had difficulty. Harry Truman had difficulty. Partly it's just being in the last 2 years and people don't look to you as a center of power anymore. But it's particularly difficult for presidents, I think, who've lost the faith of the people, even in their own party. In some ways, I'd liken this to the last year of Harry Truman's administration. He got involved in the Korean War, which was growing unpopularity. A lot of Democrats were moving away from him. He sensed he couldn't get a renomination. It was pretty clear he was history. And he couldn't get anything out of Congress his last 6 months.
Yeah. Paul Soglin, what do you think of that non-binding resolution condemning the troop buildup?
I wish it did go further. But before I do that, I just want to say one thing. While I am an attorney, I don't practice law, and I'm not in an attorney role at my company, and anything I say here is my own views.
Okay.
But, you know, the role of the soldiers, I want to go back for a moment to that, because as you recall, when the president mentioned supporting our troops, everybody in the audience rose, regardless of party, and applauded. But then we get to this divisive issue, which becomes more and more important as the troop buildup approaches, that we want to honor them, and we want to honor and recognize their valor and their heroism. But that does not emanate from the purpose of the war. That emanates from their own personal actions and their conduct on the battlefield. And what we've got here is a president who is attempting to say that if you don't recognize the war itself, you are doing a disservice to these soldiers. My thought is that we should put in a timetable for withdrawal. We should put in a calendar and make it clear to the Iraqi government what is going to happen in terms of our actions, and that will not be the end of it, but it'll be the end of our military role. The other thing that we're missing in this discussion is the cost of this war. I mean, it is just incredible what the expenses are. And for example, the cost of 1.5 months of the war, $15 billion, could provide health coverage for 1 year for 9 million children in this country. 2 or 3 days of the war would get us all the radiation detectors and would get us all the screening devices so we could check everything that comes into the ports and on the planes into this country, which we're told we can't afford.
So then maybe...
Well, I disagree, Paul. Mm-hmm. There must be, at your age, enough cynicism to realize that if we were not spending that money in Iraq, it's hard to believe it would end up in child health care. I mean, the nature of our national political system is that it would go into earmarks for statues of great congressmen in Cleveland. It's always easy to say that if we weren't spending the money on the war, we could have new schools. There is no evidence in American history that money not spent on wars ends up in schools.
John, I'm afraid you are right. but I still want to make the point as to what is driving us into debt, what is driving us into another decade of unbalanced budgets. And that at least if we were going to do that, there are so much more productive things. I mean, you know, we did it once in this country, and I can't believe, again, we haven't learned a lesson in history, and I hope here you will allow the analogy, and that was the GI Bill. I mean, it was not intended to stimulate this nation's economy. It was not intended to produce scientific breakthroughs with all that brain power that was allowed to explore our campuses. But when we sent all those returning GIs, it more than paid for the, obviously, 100 times over, it paid for the cost of the bill.
We have a number of callers who would like to talk with you. David in Madison is with us first. Hi, David.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I love your show. Thanks. Frankly, I'd rather spend the money on statues for Cleveland congressmen than killing children in Iraq. As far as Mr. Bush's sales pitch, I don't believe that the people are buying it anymore. Clearly, Congress isn't buying it anymore. But the good news is that the people are really fed up. At the top of the hour and during your news summary, you had a mention of a march in Washington this Saturday. There will also be a march in Madison. So anyone who's listening now should come to Madison at noon in the Library Mall. There will be a march down State Street.
Well, let's get that plug in, David. But I'm interested, Paul Soglin, the Vietnam War analogy, bringing it back a little bit. Some are saying that the anti-Iraq war protest movement is just not nearly where it was during the Vietnam age. What do you say?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. How's that for a good political answer? Mm-hmm. It is not because of the fact that we do not have a draft. And so the sense of urgency and the pressure that it was put on so many families during the Vietnam era simply doesn't exist today. On the other hand, when you look at the rapidity with which the opposition to this war has grown, especially since we don't have the pressure of the draft, I think that this has been a relatively successful. I mean, we haven't stopped the war. Mm-hmm. We've certainly done a good job of changing the Congress and making the president recognize that he's got a failure on his hands.
Yeah. John Sharpless?
I think the erosion of support for this war has been largely independent of the anti-war movement. They've certainly been there from the beginning. But I really think this is a case of lots of Americans who thought it was an okay idea or perhaps even a good idea. And they just watched it kind of melt away. And I was thinking recently about what hurt Republicans in this last off-year election. And I really don't think it had to do with the national discussion about tactics in the Middle East and the nature of the Middle East. And this goes to Paul's comment, I think. It had to do with young men and women coming back to small communities, particularly in Republican areas, in caskets. Just think about Wisconsin. How many times you open the paper to the local section and it says, Wisconsin young man loses his life in Iraq. Young woman loses her life in Iraq. So towns that voted Republican and have voted Republican for a long time, they lose the all-American boy they had. They lose that football star, that merit scholarship winner, the kid that really wanted to make America safe after 9/11. He went off and a roadside bomb killed him, and they want to know why. I think it's interesting, in that two-month period right before that election, when the assault on American troops escalated and the death toll surged, it made a big difference in small-town America.
John, that's interesting, because in 1965, I remember frequently saying that when we hit 4,300 casualties, which would be about 10 per congressional district in this country, there would be a tremendous impact, and the opposition to the war would grow. Well, we hit 4,300 casualties, deaths, and we just shot up, you know, all the way up to 44,000 before it was 45,000 before it was over. In that instance, it didn't have that kind of impact.
I think it was very important to the erosion of that middle support.
But why, you know, I think you're right that the casualties we've had now has made a difference. But I guess the question I've got is, why does it make such a difference now as opposed to in the Vietnam War, where we were more accepting?
It's
of
a different
the casualties.
Era. It's a different era. And I really think that...
Do you think anything has to do with the media and the way that each casualty can now be individualized mm-hmm. and brought home?
I think it's very powerful, the way in which it's covered. And also, there's an interesting thing that's happening now. Because we reacted to our... what we perceived to be our hostility to the young men who went to Vietnam, blaming them for the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether we did or not, you know, Paul and I know that there was a lot less spitting on the troops than the media claimed.
Okay. Right.
But there was a perception that we mistreated those young men when they came home. We've now learned to respect the soldier, even if we hate the war. And I think that makes...
That is a significant difference.
It mm-hmm. makes those fallen soldiers still dignified and important and vital. Obviously, the lives of those Vietnam men out of Paul's and my generation, they were just as vital and important, but we lived in an atmosphere then in which they got blamed. We don't blame these kids now. I'm glad of that. They had nothing to do with this. They just stepped forward when the president said fight. we've grown up a bit in terms of separating the soldier from the war. And I think it's something, if I might go on here for a second, it's something that empires figure out. The Brits sent men to die all over Africa and India. And one of the things that the British people never blamed them for imperialism. Those soldiers were always respected, no matter how goofy the war was, you know, like the Zulu War. What are you doing in the middle of Africa? They always respected the British soldier. And I think it's really important now, and it's one of the good things I've seen on both. I get tired of Bush blaming Democrats for being unpatriotic. That's such a dumb challenge. It's just so dumb. Clearly, this really isn't a question of patriotism. It's a question of whether or not this is a worthwhile effort and whether or not it's working.
Let me play U.S. Senator Russ Feingold saying that this non-binding resolution that opposes the troop buildup in Iraq, saying that that's weakened. This is what really needs to happen.
And now Congress must use its main power, the power of the purse, to put an end to our involvement in this disastrous war. And I'm not talking here only about the surge or escalation. It is time to use the power of the purse to bring our troops out of Iraq.
Paul Soglin?
I agree. Just no question about that. It's time to take some very decisive steps and start reordering both our priorities and allowing the nations of the Middle East to start taking control of their own destiny.
John Sharpless?
It won't happen. We all know, Republicans and Democrats know, Russ is a different kind of breed in Congress. He's always taken, whether you like what he says or you don't, because he's always taken the rough road.
And he's always been right.
Well, I don't know if he's always right, but he certainly has the courage to take the rough road. Most of the Democrats that are there, I think, would be very, very uneasy with putting their name to an expenditure curtailment bill, because they would feel, and they might be called accountable. This is where we do come down to troops, that cutting off the money for a flak jacket or another Hummer or AR-15s or medicine would make them look like they are going after the men and women in the field. There's another problem here. We've approved so much money for this project, and it's already in the pipeline. The president can be largely indifferent to such a bill. Probably he could be almost out of office before he's going to be literally out of money on this thing. It might be a gesture, and Feingold, bless him, you might be able to talk a few rebels into it, but I would be shocked if you had a lot of these Democrats sign on to an expenditure curtailment bill.
Philip in Little Chute is with us. Hi, Philip.
Good morning. We have one of the things that I think has not been looked at often enough is Saddam's initial response to all the pressure he was getting to pull out of the war, or to allow inspectors in, and fact that the UN never.
Yeah, Art. What about the news this week? Let's talk about something that happened in the news this week.
Well, you're talking about the State of the Union, and it's been all war since you started the conversation here. And that's what I'm getting
at. Yeah, thanks very much, Art. Laverne in Monroe.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
It has to be the State of the Union speech and President Bush and more war, and I think it's over oil, and I think he thinks it's his oil. They lost the House of Representatives, and Nancy Pelosi was sitting behind him, and I don't think he had a clue how she ever got sitting behind him. I think the Democrat response when Jim Webb talked, he said more in 10 minutes than President Bush said in 50.
All right. What do you think of the Democratic response, Paul Soglin?
The Democratic response was what you would expect. I would actually hope to get more from the Democrats, which is something they have needed since for 20 years now, which is a coherent program for this country. Whether we liked it or not, Newt Gingrich had one. Whether we liked it or not, the first Bush campaign had one. And I'll give Howard Dean has done one very good thing, which he's determined to make the Democratic Party a national party. That's step one. Step two, and they've got to get to work on this for 08, there's got to be a statement of principle with specifics. They are on that track. I mean, there's some small things that were done here early on, like the minimum wage, and there's a few others in the hopper. But the Democrats are going to have to get it together.
I fully agree, Paul. I think that I think parties that are in the minority tend to get very good at criticism. This happened to, you might remember, Republicans back in the 70s were very good at criticism, but they don't develop skills for leadership. And part of it, it's one thing to say we don't like Bush. It's another thing, we don't like Republicans. We don't like tax cuts or whatever they don't like. But I think Paul's right. The American people are waiting for the Democrats to come with a broader message. And I love my mom very much. I miss her so much. And she was an old-fashioned FDR Democrat. And the reason why she was is I think what Democrats have that Republicans should have, or perhaps they have and they never say it well, but what Democrats have is a sense of humanity. They have message. Their message is about helping people. And Americans believe in helping people. We believe that we're a charitable society that has empathy for people who have been marginalized and are downtrodden. I think they should return to that. I think that trying to keep up with Republicans on tax cuts is loony, you know, trying to out-tax cut the opposition. They should stay with what FDR gave them as a message and Harry Truman. They should stay with that message of helping people who've been marginalized to be part of the American dream.
We need to take a short pause, and then we'll continue talking with John Sharpless, professor of history at UW-Madison, a Republican candidate for Congress in 2000, and Paul Soglin, former mayor of Madison and a former Democratic candidate for Congress in 1996. 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number if you'd like to bring up a topic from the news this week. We'll move on from the State of the Union address to some other issues. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Join Kathleen Dunn coming up after 9 o'clock when she talks with a guest about global warming and the Kyoto Treaty. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're reviewing the news of the week with John Sharpless and Paul Soglin, and let's talk about this announcement that some of us caught on a website on Saturday.
I announced today that I'm forming a presidential exploratory committee. I'm not just starting a campaign, though. I'm beginning a conversation with you, with America, because we all need to be part of the discussion if we're all going to be part of the solution.
And what do you think of Hillary Clinton officially joining the fray, Paul Soglin?
Why do we have to start with me?
Why not?
I don't know. I'm in that camp where I really question whether or not she's electable. I'm still not sure, other than on health care, what she stands for. And I'm wondering how much of my perception of her is crafted by the media. So I plan to do, over the next few months, a real examination of Hillary Clinton.
And John Sharpless.
I noticed that Liz Taylor gave her $100,000.
Yes.
And if,
wow.
If Liz thinks she's good, boy, she must be good. I'm going to have a conversation with America. Talk about liberal buzzwords, you know. Let's change the world one cappuccino at a time, sweetheart. I mean, this is just, I think it'll be great. I'm going to speak as a Republican right now. I'd love to see them nominate this woman. It would just be fantastic. It's what every Republican hopes for. All the polls show that everybody's decided whether they like Hillary Clinton or not. It's up around something like 95% of the American. They either like her or they don't. And it's roughly divided. But she's got nobody to move. I don't know what she would say to move voters from the I don't like Hillary side to the I like Hillary side. What's she going to say? Anything she says to the people who don't like her, she's going to lose people like Paul. She's going to start saying, well, I'm really not as liberal as you think I am. I'm a closet a conservative. No, she can't do that. To the extent that she moves toward her opposition, because she's dealing with such a small margin, it isn't like some of these other candidates that have lined up. Richardson is here's an interesting guy who has a resume that's very impressive. A lot of Americans haven't decided on Bill Richardson, so he can work with them on issues. I think it's over and done with Hillary. I don't think she can win. Up against McCain, I think she'd be a disaster.
So what? Who's going to be? Obama? Would he be better?
Well, I really think the Democrats right now have a lot of interesting people. They have more going on than Republicans do. Paul, you can help me out here. I think there are almost six candidates, aren't there?
There is, and my feeling about the rest of them is really similar to Hillary in that, I'm not sure who they are. I realize that leaves me as an exception when it comes to Hillary, since 95% of the American people are confident they know who she is. But I think I'm with the majority in terms of not being sure about the others. I really think this is going to come down to the competency factor rather than issues. I've always felt that there's somewhere around 35 to 40% of the electorate makes its decision based on liberal views. There's another 35 to 40% that makes its decision based on conservative views, and somewhere there's about 20% in the middle that basically says, I'm not really all that concerned about the ideology of the candidate. I simply want a competent leader. That's why Ronald Reagan, despite the fact that my judgment, he wasn't all that competent, but there was a perception, and that's why Ronald Reagan could do what he did. That's why Wisconsin can keep on electing a Tommy Thompson and a Russ Feingold. There's that group in the middle that perceives each of them being competent in their own right, and I think that's what it's going to come down to.
Governor Doyle's going to deliver his State of the State address next week, Tuesday, and he's going to include proposals to have a statewide smoking ban in public places, workplaces, bars, and restaurants, and also a hike of $1.25 a pack in the cigarette tax. Let's chew on this info from Sean Johnson's report on this announcement.
Doyle called his plan a broad assault on tobacco. He says it's proven that raising the cost of a pack of cigarettes will keep young people from smoking and give adults an incentive to quit. The governor says there's an obvious trend in society toward less smoking.
It's very evident which way we're going. The real issue for us, I think, is how fast are we going to get there and how many lives are going to be affected by our delaying in getting to that point.
The governor's proposal would actually increase cigarette taxes by more than anti-tobacco groups had asked for. Doyle says the extra hike will provide the shock that's needed to drive smoking rates down by about 20%. It will also give Wisconsin one of the highest state tobacco taxes in the nation. Republicans immediately criticized the plan. Assembly GOP Majority Leader Jeff Fitzgerald says it moves in the wrong direction for a state that's already overtaxed.
You know, a tax is a tax any way you look at it, whether it be at a specific targeted set of people or, you know, if it's a tax increase on everybody, it's still a tax.
Fitzgerald says the governor's proposed smoking ban also goes too far by prohibiting smoking in taverns. Fitzgerald says that as long as tobacco is a legal product, tavern owners should be able to choose whether or not they want to allow it. Doyle will ask lawmakers to support his proposals during his State of the State address next week. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
All right, we'll start with you, John Sharpless. What do you think of those ideas?
It's not an assault on tobacco. It's an assault on smokers. Let's be absolutely clear about this. This is an assault on smokers. We're going to beat up on a group of addicted people one more time. I'm not a smoker. I consider myself very lucky. I never started up, so I've never struggled with it, but I watched my father struggle with it, my sister and my daughter. I've watched them struggle with the addiction. These are addicted people. I don't know why we've become so angry at them. We want them, not only have we driven them out of the bars, we don't even want them in the parking lot anymore.
He's trying to help smokers.
Yeah,
isn't he?
This is where I get to be a libertarian. Let me help myself. Thank you very much. This is one of those cases where it's a bipartisan, self-righteous effort. This really reveals that Doyle is a good old-fashioned Madison liberal. He's going to change behavior in a bar in Rhinelander. It shows that this is a guy who's never sat on a bar stool and watched a Packer game with a couple of guys and a beer. The good old boys are going to go crazy up north. On taxing cigarettes, fine. It's, you know, it's an inelastic demand curve, despite his claims that it substantially alters use. There's very little for that, very little evidence of that. This is one of those hypocrisies. If it turns out it reduces smoking and purchasing of cigarettes, the revenues go down and the tax doesn't work as a revenue source. If it turns out that it doesn't reduce the number of smokers, then it serves as a revenue source. You can't have both. So it's like whiskey taxes. It's like a tax on condoms if you don't like sex. It's just one more time of the state butting into people's decision-making.
Yeah, Paul Soglin.
John, I'm surprised. I thought this was your opportunity to give some advice to Republicans to save their party. First off, I think that a statewide ban on smoking in public places is exactly what we need. When the Principality of Madison adopted its own ban a couple of years ago, my quarrel with it was not the ban itself, but the fact that it was the inappropriate level of government to conduct such a regulation. It's best done at the state level. If I was a Democrat, I'd just keep hammering and hammering and hammering this one home. I'm not a big fan of government by referendum as they have in California, but boy, I wish we could have a statewide referendum on this question. It would do exactly for the Democrats what Gard mistakenly thought that the amendment on gay rights would gay marriage would do here in the last November election. The people of this state are just so opposed to the use of tobacco. They're not opposed to the tobacco smoker. I think where anger is directed is towards the companies, especially after we learned, I think it was last night, that there's a significant increase in the last several years of the nicotine content of cigarettes, making them even more addictive. But what we got going here is a solid public health issue. And, the tax, with me, the tax is fine. John, you're right. If the tax does generate a reduction in consumption, it is going to cut down revenues. I'd be glad to see that in that particular instance.
Tavern League wants to have an exemption so the mom-and-pop bars don't have to adhere to this smoking ban. John Sharpless, would that go get through?
I'm a smoker, and I like smoke-free environments. This is my personal preference. And I'm not arguing that this is not an addictive drug that hurts people. That's not my argument. But it's part of a culture, particularly outside of Madison, it's part of a culture that, and these people are fully aware that they're troubled with it. They try to quit all the time. Beating these people up, making their life miserable, sending them out to the parking lot, charging them more for their addiction is not very helpful.
Yeah, but John, you're forgetting about all the people who are affected by the secondhand smoke. I mean, I was a smoker, and I've paid for it. I've had a bypass. One of the things I feel terrible about was all those cigarettes I lit up in classrooms at the Madison campus. And now I just wonder how the people next to me survived. And I can't understand how people let us smoke in class.
Yeah, I laugh because we used to be able to smoke at Wisconsin Public Radio when I first started here, too. Yeah.
Well, Paul can remember when you walked into the front door of the union, you used to smell marijuana in there.
Well, that too.
It seems to me that the hypocrisy of this state, and I've got to blame a Republican for this, was when Scott McCallum sold off our tobacco settlement, and that money was supposed to go appropriately for education. That was that was the penance that the tobacco companies paid Americans as a compensation for their crime, and we just sold that off. I thought that was apparently, I don't understand this. Doyle says there may be a second chance at getting back some of the returns on that.
Refinancing the bonds or something. Yeah. I didn't quite get that either. But let me get a caller in on this. Joan in Beaver Dam. Hi, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. This is one topic that I'll tell you really gets into my skin. anybody that says that we are not asking people to quit, we don't have a good reason, because we do. We have enough evidence, enough proof, enough testimonies, and this is people that have been converted to Christianity, converted in their own lives about the evil that they carried in their hands. And we know that...
Joan, I'm sorry. We're almost out of time here. What's your main point here?
Main thing is, let's not be blinded by cigarette smoke anymore.
Banned cigarettes is her main point, John Sharpless.
Well, we learned in the 1920s, when we banned alcohol, how successful prohibition is. One of the things that's interesting about the tobacco crusade is on the East Coast, where they have very high taxes on cigarettes, the contraband cigarette market now is flourishing. And it seems to me, Paul and I would agree on this, our failed drug policy suggests that outright prohibition on addictive substances does not resolve the problem.
Yeah. John, I think you're hitting on what we really need to start focusing on the next level in this discussion, which is, as it becomes more and more difficult to obtain cigarettes, what are we going to do? Are we going to use the prohibition model? Are we going to treat it like marijuana? I mean, obviously, neither of those work.
Yeah. We only have a minute or so to go. I wanted to, Paul Soglin, get your take on a story we heard in the news just before we started. It's current Madison Mayor Dave Cheslevich saying he wants the city of Madison to vote on streetcars in a binding referendum. Should Madison have some streetcars?
No. No, and it was about 2-3 weeks ago that I put on my blog that I was not going to support any candidate for city office this time around, unless they made it very clear they supported a referendum on this subject. I simply don't think Madison has the density to justify streetcars. When you would take the same dollars and put them into the public bus system, we'd get a much bigger bang, much better result.
Very quickly, John Sharpless.
I absolutely agree with Paul. Actually, I'm a big advocate of donkey carts.
All right. You know, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time, unfortunately. John Sharpless, Paul Soglin, thanks to both of you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Take care.
Paul Soglin, former mayor of Madison, a Democratic candidate for Congress in 1996. He currently works for Epic Systems. John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW-Madison, was a Republican candidate for Congress in 2000. Thanks to both of them for reviewing the news of the week. A reminder that the State of the State Address is next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. We'll have live coverage here on the Ideas Network, and then on Wednesday morning, all morning long, we'll talk about the State of the State. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.